Upsie stiffens his body, tries to reach his hands down to his balls. Of course, they don't reach. Actually tries to pull away from the door. Oh, by the way, will I see you at lunch, Bob? The menu said something about chicken divan or salad of your choice. Knowing me, I expect I'll have both. What do you mean, what happened? I told you it's a funny story. Fletch is a funny man. You can't figure out what happened? Geez, Bob, you're no better than Upsie. The church doors swung inward, Bob. Upsie couldn't see that because of the drapes. Fletcher? Oh, he left through the sacristy door. Gee, Bob, I thought you knew Fletcher. Chapter 16. From tape, Station 22, Room 42, Leona Hatch. Ready for lunch? Just putting on my hat. Why do you need a hat? We're not leaving the building. If your hair were as thin as mine, Nettie, I'd never leave the house, Nettie Horn said. You feel you must have a trademark, Leona, as if anybody cared. I like wearing a hat. With your vanity, I just don't understand how you let yourself get so drunk. What do you mean? You didn't make it to dinner last night, Leona. You did? I did. And what happened to you after dinner, Nettie? I'm not perfectly sure. I seem to remember singing around a piano. Nettie, I put myself to bed in a proper manner last night. I even folded my clothes and removed my corset and got under the covers. In fact, I totally unraveled my corset. That took great concentration and deliberation, although why I felt I had to do it, I don't know. Had a dickens of a time putting it all together again this morning. Where did you sleep last night? I woke up in a chair in my room. Fully dressed? Well, I know you, Nettie. Somebody just dumped you there. Probably a bellman. Well, I was in my bed with my corset off. Now don't give me any more of your nonsense about my being drunk in public. Fletch switched off the marvelous machine to answer his phone. Fletcher, old buddy, old friend. Don? Yes, sir, I'm here. If this is Don Gibbs, I thought we established when I called you from Washington that we are not buddies, not friends, but at the most useless acquaintances. How can you say that? Come on, didn't we learn the Northwestern fight song together? I never learned beyond the first verse. What could be verse? Don Gibbs said. Learning the second verse. Golly, Don, you sound full of bonhomie. Does that taste anything like wild turkey bourbon? You government guys drink good stuff. Seldom do I personally get the opportunity to squeeze the taxpayer's wallet. How goes the convention? If I ask where you are, will I get an answer? Try it and see. Where are you, Don? Here. Terrific. Can you be a little more precise as to where here is geographically at the moment? Hendricks Plantation. Hendricks, Virginia, U.S. of A. Here? You've got it. What are you doing here? Thought we'd come along, see how you're doing. We? Bob is with me. Who's Bob? Bob Engelhart, my honored and beloved department head. What are you doing here? This Walter March murder, Fletch, it sort of worries us. Why should it? What's the CIA got to do with it? The murder of a private citizen within the United States is a purely domestic matter. March newspapers has foreign bureaus, hasn't it? Boy, you guys have elastic minds. By the way, how much poop have you got on the murder? Well, I've got it solved. Really? Yeah. Out with it. No. Wait a minute, Fletch. Bob wants to speak to you. I'll come back on the line. Mr. Fletcher? Robert Engelhart was trying to lighten his ponderous tone. May I call you Fletch? I don't know why you call me at all. Well, to answer that question, we need you to cover for us. Don has been calling your room since we arrived, so you wouldn't express surprise at seeing us at the various functions here at the hotel, and blurt out our actual employer. I was playing tennis with what's-her-name. Who? What is her name? Exactly. Fletch, we're here as observers from the Canadian press. Anyone in Canada know that? No. Our official story is that we're thinking of setting up a similar convention next year in Ontario. And naturally, we expect you to allow no one here, now or ever, to know whom we actually represent. Why in the hell should I cover for you guys? For all of the above reasons. Again? Failure to file federal tax returns, evasion of federal taxes, deporting United States currency illegally. I've always heard it's more difficult to keep a fortune than to make one. Then we have your complete cooperation? How could you think otherwise? Robert Engelhart said, "Good. Here's Don." After a pause in which the clink of an ice cube against a glass was audible, Don Gibbs said, "Fletch?" "Gee, Don, your superior didn't say he was looking forward to meeting me." "Actually, Fletch," Don said, "he's not." "Gee, Don. How's the taping going? Got much dirt yet?" "It's a marvelous machine, very sensitive." "What do you have so far? Anything good?" "Mostly toilets flushing, showers running, typewriters clacking, and a lot of journalists talking to themselves in their rooms. I never realized journalists are such lonely people." "That all?" "No, I also have a complete tape of the New World Symphony from somebody's radio." "You must have more than that." "People snoring, coughing, sneezing." "Okay, Fletch, expect we'll see you around." "Never saw you before in my life. By the way, Don, what room are you in?" "Suite 3. They had to give us the suite in which Walter March was murdered. They didn't have any other place to put us." "Really living it up, huh?" "The rule book says we can take a suite if nothing else is available." "I'm glad I'm not a taxpayer," Fletch said. "Bye." Fletch switched his marvelous machine to Station 5, Suite 3. "Turkey in school," Don Gibbs was saying, "always outdoing his own thing." "More," Robert Engelhart said. "No one could ever figure out what it was. Gone night after night. Never came to the parties. Used to make jokes about Fletch. They always began with, 'Where's Fletch?' And then someone would make up something ridiculous, like sniffing the bicycle seats outside the girls' dorms. Come on, finish your drink. Let's go to lunch." "Hey, Bob, we're supposed to be journalists, aren't we? Journalists live it up. I saw a movie once." Chapter 17. 1 p.m., lunch, main dining room. Arriving late at lunch, Fletch put his hand out to Robert McConnell, who was already looking warily at him from his place at the round table, and said, "Bob, I apologize. Let me buy you a drink." Robert McConnell's jaw dropped, his eyes bugged out, and he turned white. Robert McConnell bolted from the table and from the room. Crystal Fione was staring at Fletch. Fletch said to her, "What's the matter with him? Just trying to apologize for accusing him of murder." Freddie Arbuthnot looked clean and fresh after their tennis. Clearly she had sung her Who Boy song again. Lewis Graham had taken one of the empty seats at the table, and Fletch shook hands with him, saying, "Slumming, eh?" The man shook hands as would an eel, if eels were familiar with human social graces. Lewis Graham was a television network's answer to the newspaper editorial. A gray man with a long face and narrow chin, who apparently confused looking distinguished and intellectual with looking sad and tired, every night for 90 polysyllabic seconds he machine-gunned his audience with informed, intellectual opinion on some event or situation of the day or the week, permitting the people of America to understand there were facts they didn't have yet, and probably wouldn't be able to comprehend if they did have them, without his experience, and understandings they could never have without his incisive intelligence. The trouble was, his colleagues read the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlanta Constitution, the Los Angeles Times, Time, Newsweek, Foreign Affairs, and the Old Testament as well as he, and could identify the sources of his facts, insights, and understandings precisely night after night. Other journalists referred to Lewis Graham as the Reader's Digest of the air. It was questioned whether behind his grayness he had any personality he had not lifted from newsprint. Lewis Graham said, "I didn't know where to sit. I expect lunch is the same at all the tables." Crystal Fione was still staring at Fletch after he sat down. Freddie said, "A fairly even match, if I may say so. 6-4 you, 6-4 me, 7-5 us."
"Me," said Fletch.
"It was just your chauvinist pride."
"Me," said Fletch, "me."
"Not a clear victory. Your arms and legs are longer than mine."
"The thing about tennis," Lewis Graham said, "is that someone has to win and someone has to lose."
Crystal turned her stare at Lewis Graham. They all stared at Lewis Graham.
"Tennis always provides a clear victory," Lewis Graham said.
Fletch asked, "Did you read that somewhere?" Crystal said to Fletch,
"I ordered you both the chicken divan and the chef's salad."
"Thank you for thinking of me," Fletch said. I don't want both.
You want one of them?
Yes, I want one of them.
Then I'll have the other one. Well, why should I embarrass myself by ordering two meals for myself when I can embarrass you instead? You need a little embarrassing.
Why should you be embarrassed?
Oh, come off it, Fletch, Cristofione said. Have you ever made love to a really fat girl?
Graham shifted his elbows uncomfortably on the table.
I'll weigh the question, Fletch said.
As fat as I am?
Fletch said, it's a heavy question.
Lewis Graham cleared his throat and said,
You appear to be giving light answers.
During the lunch, Fletch ate the salad, Crystal ate two divans, which caused Lewis Graham to quip that all she needed more to entertain was a fireplace and a coffee table. The topic of Walter March's murder arose, and after listening a while to Graham's reporting what he had read in the morning newspapers, complete with two Old Testament references to the transitory nature of life, Crystal raised her large, beautiful head from the trough and said,
You know, I heard Walter March announce his retirement.
I didn't know he had, said Graham.
He did.
So what? Freddie asked. He was over 70.
It was more than 5 years ago.
Men look forward to their retirements with mixed feelings, said Graham. On the one hand, they desire retirement in their weariness. On the other, they shirk from the loss of power, the vacuum, the retirement which is attendant upon, he said, retirement.
Crystal, Freddie, and Fletch stared at Lewis Graham again.
Was it a public announcement? Fletch asked.
Oh, yes, Crystal answered. A deliberate, official public announcement. It was at the opening of the new newspaper plant in San Francisco. I was covering. There was a reception, you see, big names and gowns and things. So, of course, the darling editor sent a woman to write it all up. There were scads of those little hors d'oeuvres, you know, chicken livers wrapped in bacon, duck and goose pâtés, landing fields of herring and sour cream.
Crystal, Fletch said.
What?
Are you hungry?
No, thanks. I'm having lunch.
Get on with the story, please.
Anyway, Walter was to make one of those wow-wee, whiz-bang, look at our new plant, look at us, what an accomplishment speeches, and he did. But he also took the occasion to announce his retirement. He said he was 65, and he had instituted and enforced the retirement age of 65 throughout the company, and although he understood better how people felt reaching 65, being forced to retire, when he felt in the prime of his life, years of experience behind him, years of energy ahead of him, wasted, blah, 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 he was no exception to his own rules. He was retiring himself.
I guess ultimately he considered himself an exception to his own rules, Freddie said.
He always did, said Lewis Graham.
He even said he was having his boat brought around to San Diego and was looking forward to sailing the South Pacific with wife of umpty-umpt years, Lydia. He painted quite a picture, sailing off into the sunset, hand in hand with his childhood sweetheart, sitting on his poop or whatever it is yachts have.
He owned a big catamaran, didn't he? Freddie asked.
A trimaran, said Lewis Graham. Three hulls. I chartered it once.
You did? Fletch said.
A few years ago, the Lydia. I used to consider Walter March a sort of a friend.
What happened? Fletch said. Boat spring a leak?
Lewis Graham shrugged.
I don't see anything unusual in this, Freddie Arbuthnot said. Lots of people get cold feet when it comes time to retire.
Fletch said, Did he say when he was going to retire, Crystal? I mean, did he give any definite time?
In 6 months. The new plant was opened in December, and I clearly remember his saying he and Lydia were westward hoeing in June.
He was definite?
Definite. I reported it. We all did. It's all in the files. Walter March announces retirement, and he said the greatest joy of his life was that he was leaving March newspapers in good hands.
Whose? Freddie asked.
Crystal said, Guess.
The little bastard, Lewis Graham said. Junior.
I saw him this morning, Crystal said, in the elevator. Boy, does he look awful. Dead eyes staring out of a white face. You'd think he'd died instead of his father.
Understandable, said Fletch.
Junior looked like he was going somewhere to lie down quietly in a coffin, Crystal said. Everyone in the elevator was silent.
So, Fletch said, why didn't Walter March retire when he said he was going to? Is that the question?
Because, Lewis Graham said, the bastard wanted to be president of the American Journalism Alliance. That's the simple reason. He wanted it badly. I can tell you how badly he wanted it.
Graham saw the three of them staring at him again,
realized how forcefully he had spoken and relaxed in his chair. He said, "I'm just saying he wanted to cap his career with the presidency of the AJA. He spoke to me about it years ago. He was canvassing for support 8-10 years ago." "Did you offer him your support?" Fletch asked. "Of course I did, then. He had a few years to go before retirement, and I had a whole decade. Then..." The waiter was pouring the coffee. "Two or three times," Lewis Graham continued, "he got his name placed in nomination. I never did. And he never won." Graham pushed the coffee cup away from him. "Until last year, both our names were placed in nomination." "I see," Fletch said. "Well," Graham said, "I don't have the advantage Walter March had. I don't own my own network." Graham looked a little abashed. "I have to retire the first of this year. There's no way I can hang on." Crystal said, "And the AJA bylaws say our officers have to be working journalists." "Right," Graham said with surprising bitterness. "Not retired journalists." "Is that why you stopped considering Walter March a friend?" asked Freddy. "Because you opposed each other in an election?" "Oh, no," said Graham. "I'm an old man now with much experience, especially political. There are very few things in the course of elections I haven't seen. I've witnessed some very dirty campaigns in my time." Graham deferred to the younger people at the table. "I guess we all have. One just never expects to be the victim of such a campaign." A bellman was having Fletch pointed out to him by the head waiter. Graham said, "I guess you all know Walter March kept a whole barnyard full of private detectives." Crystal, Freddy, Fletch said nothing. Graham sat back in his chair. "End of story," he said. The bellman was standing next to Fletcher's chair. "Telephone, Mr. Fletcher," he said. "Would you come with me?" Fletch put down his napkin and rose from his seat. "I wouldn't bother you, sir," the bellman said, "except they say it's the Pentagon calling." Chapter 18. "One moment, sir. Major Letvin calling." Fletch had been led to a wall phone down the corridor from the entrance to the dining room. Leaving the dining room, he had seen and ignored Don Gibbs. Through the plate glass window at the end of the corridor, a couple of meters away, he could see the midday sunlight shimmering on the car tops in the parking lot. "How do?" the major said. "Do I have the honor of addressing Irwin Maurice Fletcher?" The drawl was thicker than Mississippi mud. "Right," said Fletch. "Veteran of the United States Marine Corps?" "Yes." "Serial number 1893983? "It was. I retired it. Anyone can use it now." "Well, sir, some sharp-eyed old boy here in one of our clerical departments reading about that murder in the newspaper. You know what's his name? Where are you at?" The drawl was so steeped in courtesy, everything sounded like a question. After a moment, Fletch said, "Walter March." "Walter March? Say, you're out in the middle of things again, aren't you?" Fletch said, "Middle of lunch, actually. Anyway, this here sharp-eyed old boy, he's from Tennessee. I suspect he was pretty well known around home for shooting off hen's teeth at 100 meters. Well, anyway, reading this story in the newspaper about Walter March's murder, he spotted your name?" Again, it sounded like a question. Fletch said, "Yes." "Say, you aren't a suspect or anything in this murder, are you?"
"No."
"What I mean to say is you're not implicated in this here murder in any way, are you?"
"I wasn't even here when it was committed. I was flying over the Atlantic. I was coming from Italy."
"Well, the way this story is written, it makes you wonder. Why do journalists do things like this? Ask me, take all the journalists in the world, put them in a pot, and all you got is fish bait."
Major Letvin paused.
"Oops, sorry. You're a journalist, aren't you? I forgot that for a moment. Sports writers I don't mind so much."
"I'm not a sports writer."
"Well, he recognized your name. How many Irwin Maurice Fletchers can there be?"
Fletch restrained himself from saying, "I don't know."
"And checked against our files here at the Pentagon, and sure enough, there you were. Serial number 1893983. That you?"
"Major, do you have a point? This is long distance. You never can tell. A taxpayer might be listening in."
"That's right,"
the major chuckled.
"That's right."
There was a long silence.
Major? Point is, we've been looking for you high and low these many years.
Why?
Says here we owe you a Bronze Star. Did you know that?
I heard a rumor.
Well, if you knew it, how come you've never arranged to get decorated?
Seems to me if a fellow wins a Bronze Star, he ought to get a pin to his chest. These things are important.
Major, it's nice of you to call. No problem, no problem. Just doing my duty. We got so many people here at the Pegon, everybody doing each other's lazy, and it's a sheer pleasure to have something to do, you know what I mean? To separate breakfast from supper.
There was a man ambling across the parking lot, hands in the back pockets of his jeans.
You gonna be there a few days, Mr. Fletcher?
Where?
Wherever you are, Hendricks Plantation, Hendricks, Virginia.
Yes. The man in the parking lot wore a blue jeans jacket.
Well, I figure what I'll do is dig up a general somewhere. Believe me, that's not difficult around the Pegon. We got more generals in one coffee shop than Napoleon had in his whole army. We could decorate the Statue of Liberty with him, and you'd never see the paint peel. And move his ass down to Hendricks, Virginia. Major.
The man in the parking lot also had tight, curly gray hair.
I figure a presentation ceremony in front of all those journalists, decorating one of their own, so to speak, with a Bronze Star.
The man who had accosted Mrs. Leary in the parking lot.
Major, I've got to go. The Marine Corps could use some good press these days, you know.
Major, I've got to go in emergency. My pants are on fire. Call me back. Fletch hung up, turned around, and headed down the corridor at high speed. He found a fire door with exit written over it, pushed through it, and ran down the stairs. He entered the parking lot slowly, trying not to make it too obvious he was looking for someone. No one else was in the parking lot. The man had been walking toward the back of the area. Fletch went to the white rail fence and walked along it, looking down the slope to his right. He caught a glimpse of the man crossing behind two stands of rhododendrons. He sprung over the fence and ran down the slope. When he ran through the opening in the rhododendrons and stopped abruptly to look around, he saw the man standing under some apple trees, hands in back pockets, looking at him. Slowly, Fletch began to walk toward him. The man took his hands out of his pockets, turned, and ran further down the slope toward a large stand of pine. Behind the pine trees were the stables. Fletch noticed he was wearing sneakers. Fletch ran after him, and when he came to the pine trees, his shoes began to slip on the slope. To break himself from falling, he grabbed at a scrub pine, got sap on his hands, and fell. Looking around from the ground, Fletch could neither see nor hear the man. Fletch picked himself up and walked through the pines to the stable area, trying to scrape the sap off his hands with his thumbnails. In the midday sun, the stables had the quiet of a long lunch hour, typical of a place where people work early and late. No one was there. For a few minutes, Fletch petted the horse he had ridden that morning, asked her if she had seen a man run by, and answering for her, he went that away, and then walked back to the hotel. Chapter 19. 2 p.m. Various uses of computers in journalism. Address by Dr. Hiram Wong. Parlor. From tape. Station 1, Suite 12. Mrs. Walter March and Walter March, Jr.
Bandy called from Los Angeles, Jr. Some question he can't deal with. And Mazur called asking if he should put that basketball scandal on the wires from New York.
There was no answer.
Are you having lunch?
Lydia asked her son. No answer.
Oh, for God's sake, Junior, buck up. Your father's dead and someone has to make the decisions for the newspapers. They can't run themselves. They never have.
Another silence.
I'm ordering you lunch, she said. You can't bloody marry yourself to death.
From tape, Station 9, Room 36, Raleigh Wisham.
If you'll permit me a question first, Captain Neal. I don't know. Once you journalists start asking questions, you never stop. I've had enough opportunity to discover that. Very simply, why are you questioning me? We understand you might have had a motive to murder Walter March.
Oh?
Raleigh Wisham's voice did not have great timbre, for a man nearly 30, but there was a boy's aggressiveness in it, mixed with an odd kindliness. Listening to the tape, sitting on his bed, picking at the sap on his hands, Fletch kept expecting Wisham to say, "This is Raleigh Wisham, with love."
as if such meant anything to anybody, especially in journalism.
What motive do you think I would have for murdering the old bastard?
I know about the editorial that ran in the March newspapers calling your television feature reporting. Have I the term right? Let's see. It called it sloppy, sentimental, and stupendously unprofessional.
That's precise. I had the editorial looked up and read to me over the phone this noon.
That's what it said.
I also know that this editorial was just the beginning of a coast-to-coast campaign to put you in disgrace and get you fired from the network. Every March newspaper was to follow up with articles punching holes in your every statement, every report, day by day.
I didn't know that, but I guessed it.
Walter March had begun a smear campaign against you. Frankly, Mr. Wisham, I didn't know such things happen nowadays.
Call me Raleigh.
I think of that kind of smear campaign as being from back in the old days. Dirty journalism. Yellow journalism. What do you call it?
It still happens.
On this assignment, Captain Neal said, I'm learning a lot of things I didn't particularly want to know.
Is the campaign against me going to continue? Are the March newspapers going to continue to smear me now that Walter March is dead?
I understand it's been called off. Mr. Williams, Jake Williams, has called it off.
Good.
And not for your sake. He thinks it might hurt the image of the recently departed, leave a bad taste in the mouths of people regarding Walter March.
If that's their reasoning, I wish they'd continue it. Walter March tasted like piss and vinegar.
Interesting to see how decisions are made in the media. You people are feeding 1,000 facts and ideas into human minds a day, and I see sometimes for some pretty wrong reasons.
Very seldom. It's just that in every woodpile there's a Walter March.
Anyway, Mr. Wisham, Walter March had begun a campaign to destroy you. He was murdered. The campaign was called off.
Captain Neal, who tipped you?
I don't get you.
Who told you about the editorial and the campaign?
I'm not a journalist, Mr. Wisham. I don't have to give my sources, except in a court of law.
I'll have to wait, huh?
I intend to bring this case into court, Mr. Wisham, and get a conviction.
Why did you say that?
What do you mean?
Seems a funny thing for you to say. I mean, of course you intend to bring it into court. There was a murder. You're a cop.
Well, could it be that you've heard some not very nice things about Walter March?
I've been on the case only 24 hours.
24 hours investigating Walter March would be enough to make anyone puke.
Mrs. March assures me he hadn't an enemy in the world. And there's the fact that Walter March was the elected president of the American Journalism Alliance.
Yeah, and Attila led the Huns.
Mr. Wisham, any man with that much power
has to have a few enemies, right? Everyone loved Walter March except anyone who ever had anything to do with him.
Mr. Wisham, I have one more question.
Mr. Wisham, I'll ask the questions.
Have you ever seen me on television?
Of course.
Often?
Yes, I guess so. My working hours. I don't have any regular television viewing hours.
What do you think of me? What do you think of my work?